Okay, this is Sarah Milligan interviewing Luther Clark. Today is April. What is today's date? Do you know? April.
What now?
What's today's date? Is it the 8th or the 9th? I can't remember. Today's. Hey. Let me think.
7th.
7th.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's right there. Thanks.
Today's April. Look on there. I guess I've got that too. April 7th. 2010, and we are going to talk about his experience in World War II.
Yeah.
And so, I remember when I talked to you before, just a little bit, we talked about your experience being on a ship in the Pacific, and I remember some details, but start at the beginning. Tell me about where you are from in Kentucky, and just start where you decided to go into the military.
Well, I didn't have too much choice. I just volunteered, and that's where they sent me. I was in the Navy.
So you did volunteer. You weren't drafted.
I wasn't drafted, no. I was just a kid. But I volunteered 16th of September, 1942. That's right after Pearl Harbor.
Right.
And they sent me to Great Lakes. That's where the training was. I wasn't up there about 3 weeks. 6 weeks from the time I volunteered, I was in Kodiak, Alaska. That's how much they needed men, I guess.
Wow.
But anyhow, I spent 2 years and 2 months without getting back home in Kodiak, Alaska.
You spent all that time in Alaska? Two years?
I put me on ship, and we escorted Russian ships, merchant ships, coming over here, picking up land lease. That's what they called it, I guess. But I don't think it was ever paid for it. But
you don't think they ever paid for the lease?
Well, no, I don't think so. But the only Russian that I ever learned to say was Ocean Spasibo.
Which is?
Many thanks. That's all I could hear them Russians say.
Really?
We'd escort them all through the chain, you know, and back down to Bremerton, Washington, Seattle, and they'd be in an old fishing boat or something like that. Give it to the United States, and we'd give them a new Liberty ship, just loaded to the gunwales with everything. Anyhow, we'd escort them back across through the chain, and of course, Kiska and that too. We took those two islands while I was up there, and it's just a short jump across there to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But what I learned later on, after 2 years and 8 months, I mean 2 years and 2 months of doing this, that the supplies and the things that they were picking up over here, one of those ships that they kept was bringing over here, one of those old fishing boats, cracked a seam in the hull, and we pulled alongside of it, and we had a welder that welded the seam so they get on down here to the United States.
Yeah.
And found out that I might be telling tales out of school, but they weren't. I mean, just like the government it is right now, yeah. What we're operating under. I don't know whether they knew about it or not, but we were fighting Japan, and they were taking those supplies back over there and selling them to Japan or giving them to them or something. I don't know if it was an ally there. And when the war was over, Russia declared war on Japan. Why? I don't know. But check history. That's true. I don't know.
So we were leasing them equipment or giving them equipment, and they were turning around selling it to Japan.
Selling it or giving it to them or something. But while we were working on that old ship, some of these Russians, they could speak pretty good English, you know. And some of these Russians let the cat out of the bag instead of giving it to Japan. We were fighting Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't too long after we took Kiska and that too. When I went up there, well, there was Japanese on Kiska and that too. But spent 2 years and 2 months doing that.
Just working primarily with Russian ships.
Well, we'd still get raided by, they'd fly over and bomb us there at Dutch Harbor. We worked out of Dutch Harbor. That's about halfway from the chain, you know. It goes out to Kiskanet, too. But anyhow, they'd come over and bomb us and strafe us. We might be tied up to the dock. We might be going out somewhere. Or we might be escorting a Russian ship through the Aleutian chain.
So what would you all do if, go through a scenario of that?
We didn't have much gunpowder, just a little old DE, destroyer escorts, all we had to escort them through there.
So why would the Japanese come in and raid and bomb you? What were they looking for?
Well, I think that was after, Pearl Harbor, and they seen when they didn't succeed at Pearl Harbor that was their next chance, going to Russia, and then they'd be right down to the United States. But I don't know. People see things different. I don't know. That's the way I saw it.
Uh-huh.
But they kept me up there for 2 years and 2 months before I ever got back home.
You've got that specific. Do you know the day, too? Do you know two years, 2 months, and do you know how many days? You've got that.
Yeah, 8 days.
Down. 8 days.
That's how long I was in, was 2 years, 2 months, and 8 days. And then when I left there, got my papers, and we went back to Bremerton, Washington,
mm-hmm.
and put us on a new Liberty ship, the USS Sandoval, the APA 194.
Mm-hmm.
Named over after Sandoval County, New Mexico. And we put that in commission, and that's when everything really broke loose in the Pacific. And I was all over the Pacific for a full year.
Mm-hmm.
And like I was in the Aleutians there, escorting those Russian ships, Well, it was a year because they had 2 years and 2 months in the Aleutians, and then came back and set the first watch on the Sandoval and sent us out. The first landing we made, well, we was running the Philippines. We was in the freeing the Philippines up, getting the Japanese out there. And now on February the 19th in 1945, we made the invasion of Iwo Jima. So I was there when we raised the flag on Suribachi.
Yeah.
And
tell me about that experience. Tell me about.
Well, this APA 194, that we was in the 13th Fleet of the Pacific, and we carried 26 landing boats. That was the boats you put the Marines in, and they go in and make the landing, The front of it would drop down and land on the island where we were making the invasion. But I guess that was about the bloodiest and most brutal thing that I ever seen in all of that. But that was pitiful at Iwo Jima.
What was pitiful about it?
Well, there wasn't any black people in the Marines or Navy when I went in at all. But anyhow, the only thing we carried in these invasions was Marines. And we went in that morning on February the 19th, and we had our positions, of course, all just, I don't know how many in each convoy that had the landing boats, but we had destroyers and battleships and everything, protect us. And we put about 6 o'clock in the morning, we put the ladders over the side and lowered the boats, and then the Marines with full army pack, they went down those ladders and got in those boats. And as soon as we get the 26 boats loaded, well, they'd rendezvous out there in the circle in the ocean, just off the island. And then when all of the ships got their complement of, Marines in the boats, well, that's when, of course, they picked me. I was a signalman.
Okay.
And we had two big arc lights upon each side of the stack. And again, and you couldn't make any light, or you couldn't make any radio contact, because they could pick that up. They could read that as well as we could. And they came up upon the signal bridge. I was signalman first class then. And the old chief signalman, he came around with the officer of the deck. And he said, "Here's the man you want right here." Pointed at me. Mm-hmm. "What did I do?" So they took me around and sent me up on this big 24-inch arc light. There's one on each side of the stack on that APA 194. They gave me three letters. Of course, I don't remember what the letters were then, but just like hoisting signal flags, you know, on the yardarm. And it said, gave me a relative bearing of the battleship that had the division commander. We had the division commander, and it was on the battleship with the squadron commander. It said, "Send these three letters on that big light, see?" Mm-hmm. But we had a filter on it, and had to have a special piece of equipment to receive it. Well, anyhow, here I went up there, and he said, "As soon as you make that last letter," said, get off of that light. Get out, guy." Well, I went up there. I had much more and opened the shutters on that light, and boy, everything just broke loose all over that island. As a matter of fact, I started the war of Iwo Jima.
Through starting signals.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I sent those three letters, and we was in business. I'm telling you, I would get right down off that ladder like they told me. And I had much more and got back on deck. Of course, the signal deck was just right there where the stack was. And when I got back down there, well, one of those suicide planes come, and it didn't hit us there, but it hit right side of us. Well, anyhow, I was in there 14 days. And anyhow, the island was supposed to be secure. But during that time, after we unloaded these Marines and the assault wave went in, probably wasn't gone 15 minutes, 20 minutes at the most. And here the boats start coming back, and they had Marines in there that had arms off, legs off. But
coming back to the ship, it sounds like.
And they were still alive, but we get them back on the ship, and they die. We wasn't a hospital ship.
Yeah.
We were just a sanction form, you know, to get them out of there. And they'd die on the ship, and they'd just stack them up on the fantail of the ship, just like cardboard, stack it up there.
Yeah.
And they had a ramp built on the back of the ship, just where they could lay two Marines one side by side, but they'd put them in a canvas bag, a weighted bag. Of course, they were dead.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing they kept was their dog tag, and they'd lay two on there and draped with a flag, and the priest would make his motions, you know, and then raise that up, slide them off there, and they're still over there.
So they were buried at sea?
Yeah, buried at sea.
Was that a normal practice? Did that happen fairly often in the Navy?
Maybe 24 hours a day while we was making that invasion.
In Iwo Jima especially.
Yeah. But of course they did on the other ships too, that, you know, they'd bring them back to the ship that the number, of course, was 194, and our landing boats were 194.
Yeah.
So they'd come back to our ship. So, but that was sad.
I can't even imagine.
No, you can't.
No.
And then these people that talk about war now and in positions of leadership and one thing or another, they don't know anything about war. You've got to be there to see that.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. That's real.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, like I say, we was in there 14 days, and then came back to the Philippines, and our next invasion was Okinawa. That's where I was wounded, Okinawa. But we made the invasion of Okinawa. It wasn't nothing like the Philippines. It didn't take all 4 or 5 days, about the only time that we stayed in there. And took the Marines, just like we did there. Of course, that's an island of Japan. Mm-hmm. And we went, left that invasion. They sent us to Australia to pick up army troops to occupy Okinawa. And
so Okinawa was cleared? You all cleared the island?
Well, it was just, it's supposed to have been secure at that time. But anyhow, we went on to Australia and picked up these army troops. And, of course, going down there, we had to cross the equator. Got initiated there, you know, because you know all about the Davy Jones Locker and all that stuff.
Well, tell me about your experience. What did you have to do for that?
Well, when we got to the equator, the next morning, they announced over the PA system, still on the 194, and said everybody that, all people on the ship that hadn't been across the equator to go to such and such a compartment in the ship, and the ones that had to come to the weather deck up on the top. Of course, I hadn't been across. I had to go to the compartment, and then they let us climb up the ladder. We were all talking about, of course, we'd never been across the equator. And then they opened the door, and they let us out one by one. And you never seen such a ceremony as they had on that ship crossing that equator. They had, everything was royal. Was, well, it was invading Davy Jones's locker, is what we were doing. Everything was royal. And the first thing they had was steel drums, you know, like a barrel steel drum. And they, I don't know, must have been 7 or 8 of them welded together. And then they had a hole cut in one end and a hole cut in the other end. This was just laying out on deck. Of course, the ship was rocking, you know. And they had filled that with, the hole was up high enough, you know, that when you got out, you had to come up out of that hole. But they had that filled with just old kitchen garbage and eggshells and just kitchen slop is all it was. And I wasn't a very big guy. We were about 130 pounds, something like that. And they had these shillelaghs. It's kind of funny if you get to thinking about it. But they kind of like a sausage sack. Mm-hmm. They had made these sacks, and they tamp them with cloth or anything and soak them real good, get them wet. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't stand up and walk. You had to crawl everywhere you went. And they would take those shillelaghs. And, boy, they liked to wore me out. I'm telling you, crawling around on that deck. And finally I got to this royal bath of steel drums, and they just picked me up by my ankles, stuck my head down in that thing and just shoved me down in there. And wasn't no way to go. You wasn't coming back out because they just keep pushing them in there as fast as they go. And then I made it through there, and I got my head up, I'd come out, and got out of there, and I had to go before the royal baby. And it was a big fat guy, boatswain mate. He'd been across before, he knew it was. And there he was sitting in a, they had to kind of build a throne for him. And he was sitting up there, and they'd taken just a sheet from a bed and pinned a diaper on him. That's the only thing he had on, was that sheet, like a diaper on a baby. Mm-hmm. And you had to crawl around, and you had to kiss his big toe. And there he was sitting up there, and they'd had spread mustard all around that diaper, just like he'd had an accident, you know. And then you went from there to the royal doctor. But, well, I'll tell you about the royal doctor. Anyhow, you go to the royal doctor, and he had a
just like he's going to examine you, you know. And he had a, might have been a piece of broomstick or something like that, and just a, excuse my language, just a condom stretched over that broomstick. And I don't know whether they dipped it in quinine or what it was. And he said, open your mouth. And you, of course, he took that thing, he's like, he's examining you, your throat. And then when he took that out of there, he said, open your mouth again. And did, and he threw two pills down there, and he grabbed you and clamped your mouth together and said, swallow them pills. Swallowed those pills and never thought any more about it. So went to the, from there, went to the royal doctor, I mean, royal barber. And these great big guys, there was a chair, and they had a metal plate in the chair, and it was hooked to electricity. Of course, it was already soaking wet coming out of that shower, you know. And they had on boots and rubber gloves and one thing or another. And then they had these clippers, and they set us down in that chair. And they cut my hair across over that way. Of course, they're short anyway. Mm-hmm. Went across that way and across that way.
Over the top and over the back of your head?
Yeah, just made a cross on there. And they said that that was a royal haircut. And then when they got through with my royal haircut, they gave me a royal shampoo. And it was just old tar. Took it and on a stick and just rubbed it all over your head. Like to never got that stuff out of what hair I had left. Had just cut the rest of my hair off. Well, anyhow, went there. And then they had to go to the royal bath. And then they had some more big guys in there. And they had a kind of a poo built up. Just picked me up and threw me over in there. And those guys would just keep pushing you underwater. Couldn't give you a chance to say anything. They'd say, say polybug, say polybug. Anyhow, they said, are you a shell back? Say polybug. Just keeping it, that was a spluttering and a going on, you know. Finally, they let me up, and they said that I was a shell back, that I'd passed initiation, and I was shell back. Well, they gave me a card and everything. Still got it. Well, that was a royal bath. But after that, the next morning, of course, we were all right across the equator and on down, going on toward Australia. And people would go to the restroom, we call it the head, you know, in the Navy. And they'd go in there to urinate. And of course, I went in there and I was standing there and I looked down and it was blue. And I looked down again, it was red. Looked again, and you'd see these guys stood alongside of you, you know. And they'd look at themselves, they'd look at you, and then they'd grab herself and they'd start running, you know, go somewhere, something like real bad wrong with them. But what it was is those pills that they gave us. Something about, well, the doctors do it now, blood count, one thing. Uh-huh. But they thought that that'd ruin.
So it changed the color of your pee? Is that what? Well,
yeah,
the whole thing, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So how many people went through that process with you? How many people were being initiated? Do you remember?
Oh,
a few or
gosh,
a bunch?
Yeah. There's a bunch of them, you know, never been across. And of course, I'd never been out of Franklin, Canada with the Navy. And after that, we picked up the troops and...
The Australian troops?
The Army troops in,
yeah,
at Australia. That was in Sydney and headed back to Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we pulled in Buckner Bay late in that evening and we had a tugboat that escorted us around real close to the beach. Told us to drop anchor right there. Well, during the night, we wasn't at general quarters, but everybody was on watch, and the island, still like it was when we left and went down there, so it was been secure. And We were on, like I said, what we call 1-Able. And I went up and on the bridge, and each one of us, we had three first-class signalmen. I was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But our duty was to check the flying bridge, you know, at different intervals during the night. But we was going to unload those troops early in the morning. So during the night, my turn come, and I went up on the bridge, and flying bridge, and you'd hear these little old fishing boats. We was laying offshore, you know, as close as we could get without going aground in the bay. And those little old fishing boats would come out, the Japanese, you know, mm-hmm. and they'd throw hand grenades at us, you know. But they were 56 feet from the water up to the flying bridge, and they couldn't throw them up that high, you know. But they'd hit the ship and they'd explode. And some of them would have maybe dynamite or something in there, just a suicide trip, just like the suicide planes. And they'd take those little old ships, and here you'd see them coming down, moon might be shining or something, you could see them coming across the water. And of course, top speed might be 4 or 5 knots. That'd be flying for them. Mm-hmm. And they'd come and just ram right into our ship. That thing would explode, kill them, and just disintegrate that boat that was in.
What would it do to your
ship? That's how desperate those people. Oh, no, that didn't bother us. But anyhow, the next morning, we was getting ready to unload the Army troops to occupy the island. And I was on watch, and I looked up Buckner Bay, and the gunnery officer, the fire control shack, was on the signal bridge. And here was all of the guns. We carried a pretty good bunch of armament, and we had twin 40s, and quad 40s, 6-inch. Of course, that was pretty heavy for that type of ship. And I looked up Buckner Bay, and we have a little old reconnaissance plane, two-wing plane, that we used for reconnaissance, you know, just to scout around. But this one was Japanese. And I saw it coming. Looked like it was maybe 6 or 8 feet off the water and coming on up there. And I just went and just hollered down to the flying bridge, the wheelhouse. The officer of the deck was down there, and I said, unidentified bogey bearing so-and-so. So they went to that side of the ship, and sure enough, that thing was coming right toward us. And anyhow, the gunnery officer was practicing loading and unloading the guns. Well, I don't know whether he was smart or not or just a coward, but he turned around and left his gun, his station. He abandoned his station and jumped over the side 56 feet to the water. And wasn't a shot fired at that first one. That thing circled around, went across her bow, circled around and come in on the port side. And wasn't a shot fired at it. And it hit, of course it was a loaded with dynamite or whatever it is, it's exploding, aviation gas or something. But that exploded, it went right in the wheelhouse. I got pictures of it.
Mm-hmm.
And went in the wheelhouse, and I said there was no colored on there, but we did have 26 colored men that was cooks for the officers.
Mm-hmm.
And their battle station was in the wings of the wheelhouse, the pilot room. And we had two quad 40s, gun turret, and then on this side, and had two on this side. And there was 26 of those people, those black people that cooked for the officers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their battle station.
In the wheelhouse.
And when that thing exploded, well, I got hit in the stomach and got burnt all on my head, burnt all my hair off, eyebrows and everything. and got hit with some shrapnel. But when we're scrambling to get away from there, that's up right up on top, the highest deck that we got. And all I could see was fire and smoke. And I remember those guys that was in those gun turns just hanging. They had a strap that held them in, you know, that shoulder. They fit up in some kind of a mechanism there. They were strapped in, and they were just hanging in those guns, burning just like torches, and killed every one of them, of them.
In the wheelhouse where they were all stationed off?
Yeah, in the gun turrets and in the wheelhouse. Of course, we had other guns on the ship. But the guns were kept calling back to the officer of the deck, the gunnery officer, for permission to load their guns. And he was gone.
So they didn't shoot.
And after that, I remember them calling, "Man overboard." Now, I'm telling you, he deserted his post. And they fished him out of the water and brought him in. And anyhow, he got flash burn cream all over his face. He's never wasn't burnt because he's in the water. He got a Purple Heart. Believe it or not.
Gosh. Don't. So every single black person on your boat.
I don't know whether, you know, if he'd been there and called back for let them load the guns or not. They couldn't load them unless he said they could. But there wasn't a shot fired at that first one. But that's when I got hit.
So all the black people on your boat were killed in one area, were killed from that.
Do what now?
Every single black person on your boat was killed because they were all in that area?
Yeah.
So that's how you were injured in Okinawa from the suicide bomber. So what kind of, you sustained burns? What other injuries did you have from that?
Well, I had third-degree burns on my hands, and, of course, got started a lot of crusty stuff that never did heal over the years, you know.
Yeah.
And my ears, top of my ears, still got little places on them. And then I got a piece of shrapnel in my abdomen, my stomach. And I didn't know I was going to get a Purple Heart, but I got a Purple Heart.
Did a lot of people on that ship get Purple Hearts?
Oh, yeah. And there was a lot of them killed. But this is... Well, I thought it was in there, but I guess it didn't. No, it didn't.
Are you looking for your commendation paper?
Yeah, it was with the Purple Heart. I thought it was in there, but it didn't.
I think maybe you brought it earlier when we were here before. Maybe. Yeah,
she had a picture of it.
That's what I thought. She took a picture of a lot of this.
Yeah.
So... Okay, so what did everybody else do? I mean, how did everybody else react when this was going on? Did somebody finally take charge?
We were disabled, the ship and everything, because it just took the whole wheelhouse and everything out of that, the brains of the ship. And they have an emergency steering station near the fantail of the ship. And they pulled us out. After we unloaded the army troops and brought us back to California, had an escort that brought us back to California. And we were out of commission maybe a month or 6 weeks or something like that until they could rebuild all of that. And then they sent us right back out there, and we joined the fleet again. And I was in the invasion of Japan when the war was over. So, but went on in there, and we tied up at Yokohama and was in there 7 days. And then that's when the war was over, and that's when they got us all together and put us on another ship, and the old APA 194 was still out there when they sent me home.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
After they were
as far as I know, the thing's still operating. I don't reckon it's still there. Of course, I don't know whether Russ eat it up or not. It was an experience.
When they sent you back out, after they repaired the ship and they sent you back out, were you still injured? After 4 to 6 weeks, were you still, I mean...
Oh, yeah, I'd been in the hospital for quite a while after that, and of course, with others, too. Most of us, they left on the ship, the ones that were able to operate, just like I was a signalman. I could still use me as a signalman. When the war was over, when we was making the invasion of Japan, and we went on into Yokohama, the time come for us to, they had a point system where you could get out if, Purple Heart counted so many points, and then the time that you've been in, and the invasion that you'd made, and one thing or another, and they, we had three first-class signalmen, and they said that they needed one to stay aboard ship. And they said it didn't make any difference which one it was, and for us to work it out among ourselves, three of us.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing we knew to do was draw straws. So I didn't get the short straws. I got to come home. But a fellow from Texas, Dromer was his name, and he wasn't married, and it didn't make any difference to him, so he said he'd take it anyhow. But the one that got to stay on there, they made them chief.
Oh.
Signalman. So.
I see.
So, come on back home.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Tell me about the invasion of Japan. Like, tell me what that experience was.
Well, that's when they had that typhoon of Okinawa. You remember that? I don't guess you did. That's a long time ago. But we lost a lot of ship and personnel there, too. But they had a typhoon that almost lost the island of Okinawa. That's right at the end of Japan, you know. And as a matter of fact, when that typhoon came through there, we was on our way, or we were forming the invasion of Japan. And we were right at Tokyo Bay. Mm-hmm. when we were starting right in there. And we hadn't never had any resistance, but that's when they dropped bombs on Nagasaki, and what was the other one? That's when Harry Truman
dropped
those. Hiroshima, mm-hmm. Nagasaki. And we went on in, and the ships that had the lead personnel, those ships like the old APA 194, I don't know how it come, but we were right in the front of everything. I don't know. It just picked on us, I guess, but it was, I guess we got the job done. But anyhow, we were right there in the front. And then we went to Tokyo Bay, and we picked up a Japanese pilot. They brought him aboard our ship. So he's supposed to guide us through the channels, you know, to get us in there. And anyhow, he was scared to death. Up there, and there's, of course, on our ship, and we was in the lead, but we were going on in Tokyo Bay. But while this was going on is when they were signing that armistice that ended the war. But we still had our captain. We lost our executive officer at Okinawa when we got hit that time. The captain was, of course, he was standing right up on the flying bridge in the wheelhouse. And of course, the pilot was supposed to be telling him and an interpreter or whatever it was. I don't know. I couldn't understand nothing that was saying.
But anyhow, he was telling, you know, how fast to go with the ship. And I don't know, he had that thing going about two-thirds forward, and we were headed right toward a dock there in Yokohama. And finally, the captain, he kept looking around at him, and he'd look at that dock, and boy, we was going about two-thirds speed, something like that. And finally, our captain, he just pushed that guy out of the way, that Japanese, and rung that thing down to a stern, you know, got it backing up, and didn't stop it. That thing hit the side of that dock. Of course, it didn't hurt the ship, but I reckon if, you know, he hadn't stopped him, he'd run it over and run up on the land. I don't know.
Why did he do that?
I don't know. I was just scared, I think.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know whether people are understanding what he was saying or what, but he never said anything about slowing it down or going faster or anything. But anyhow, we went into Yokohama, and they had bombed, what was his name, Doolittle? He had done that bomb in Japan. They just about had destroyed Tokyo. That's just before we made the invasion. But we went on in, and the only thing that they saved was a big, must have been a hotel or a motel or something, was there at Yokohama.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that we could go ashore, but we had to go two at a time in pairs. And we had to buckle on a big old 45, and they let us off on the dock there, and we didn't, of course, I mean, we didn't know what to expect. But anyhow, they said, we'll give you $7 in Japanese money. And of course, we'd come up and we'd give them $7. And I'm telling you the truth, this table wouldn't hold $7 worth of Japanese money. I mean, bills just piled up.
Wow.
I never seen anything like it. But it wasn't worth anything. Wasn't nothing there to buy. But we went on in. But I started to tell you about this motel or hotel, whatever it was. But it was a fine building. And, of course, you could go in the bottom part of it, and of course these Japanese, they were still what was left of them, but the rest of the city, Yokohama, it was just leveled. It was tin, and I just destroyed, that's all it was.
Mm-hmm.
But except this building, I understood later that they saved that building because had we made the invasion of Japan, that they'd like to have that building for maybe a USO or something like that. But restrooms, that's the thing stuck in my mind. We just got to go there one day.
Mm-hmm.
Each one, you know, we go in groups, two at a time. And restrooms was big tile rooms, all great, enormous things. And they didn't have urinals and commodes and things like that. All it was just, all it was tile. And just a trough right down through the middle of it. And water run through that trough all the whole time. And, of course, we didn't see any women, but the men that over there both used the same toilet facility.
Women and men both.
Women and men both. And what they did, it just was come in there, whatever they had to do, they just straddle that trough, get their business done, and go.
Wow.
But I found that amusing too.
So did you see any Japanese people while you were looking around the city?
Oh yeah, they were dug in, they were under makeshift streets, and you might hear somebody whistle at you or holler at you, and you look down, you see a guy dug in down under some tin or something like that, and they had I still have them, was
some bowls that they had made on a lathe or something out of wood, and it looked like a big apple sitting in a bowl that they had made. And
were they selling things? They were making things and then selling them to the
GIs? Yeah, well, probably something that had been made before this happened, you know. And I don't know, they might have owned them or something, but anyhow, they couldn't talk or talk in a bargaining with you or anything. But I smoked then, and I reached in my pocket to get a cigarette, and anyhow, they wanted to trade for those cigarettes. But you could take a candy bar or a cigarette or something like that, and they'd trade you just about anything they had there for a cigarette. And one cigarette, that's all it asked for.
Wow.
And boy, I'm telling you, cigarettes cost a nickel a package. That's all it cost us. And I don't know, I traded for those. I gave that guy one cigarette, and he gave me two of those bowls that looked like an apple in a bowl. And I thought, well, I wondered what it would do if I gave him the whole package of cigarettes. And I gave him that whole package, and Lord, he got the silk pajamas, had a little package for him, and chopsticks. I still got the chopsticks. They were in a wooden box. They got a sliding top on them. But for 1 5-cent packet cigarettes.
Oh my gosh. So why do you think that it was like that there? Why do you think that they were so eager to bargain for a pack of cigarettes, anything?
Well, I'd imagine maybe they're starving to death. They're wanting a cigarette, and, you know, or a candy bar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they like candy bars, but we didn't have any candy bars.
Was there any kind of government set up there to care for people, or was it
We never seen anything like that.
No.
I mean, when Doolittle bombed that place, now he bombed it. It was destroyed. Tokyo was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I was just glad to get out of there.
So did you all end up staying in the hotel, or did you just go and look around it?
Well, that about the only thing you could see was that building that they were saving, you know, for USO or something like that.
Yeah.
And other than these people just dug in holes all around there. And maybe they'd have sheet metal or tin or something that would kind of protect them. But they just have a little space about this wide and about that long.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd never know they were there if you was walking down the street, unless one of them hollered for you and made some kind of noise.
That seems strange to me. It seems strange that people were below ground level.
Yeah, well, there wasn't any other place to go. There wasn't any other buildings at all. If you just, you know, think about that in your mind, that mm-hmm. there was nothing around there but that one building. And, of course, we were walking. We wouldn't have anything to ride in. And we'd just go around and walk around and see what was there and mm-hmm. went back to the ship. But as far as going in a store or a restaurant or anything like that, that wasn't there.
Hmm.
Completely destroyed. It's hard to realize a thing like that. But
how did you all feel about that walking around? Do you remember?
Scared.
Yeah?
Because you didn't know what they were going to do. It's like what they did at Pearl Harbor, you know. We didn't have any idea that was going to happen. And the same thing could have happened in Alaska, Dutch Harbor. We worked out of there. But I don't know. The Japanese people, of course, you have good and bad everywhere. But there's greed. That's the same way today. Everybody's out get somebody else. I don't know.
I've turned my life over to the Lord, and I'm a Christian. But that burial at sea, as long as I live, I'll never forget that.
Were you close with any of the people?
There's my old ship.
Well, there's your ship, the APA 194.
That's the history of it there.
Yeah. Here's some water if you want some water.
No, I don't.
You okay? Mean. Well, going a little bit back whenever you were in Hiroshima, whenever you all were there, you know, after the first day, what happened? I mean, after the first day and all the trauma, and you all were there for 2 weeks, weren't you? In Hiroshima?
Oh, at Iwo Jima?
Yeah, in Iwo Jima.
Oh, yeah. Well, while we were there, we never moved from where we were anchored.
Did you ever get off the ship?
Not there.
You stayed on the whole
time?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But see that light right there?
Yeah, right there in the middle.
There's one on this side, there's one on that side. There's a stack. But that's the light where they sent me to send those three letters.
Oh, gosh.
They were kind of off in this direction here.
Yeah.
Let's see. There's old Captain.
Now, did your captain survive the
yeah, he survived. But they lost our executive officer. He was the one standing on the ship and the pilot. He just pushed him out of the way. He saved the ship.
Do you think that pilot was... I mean, why did they have to have a Japanese pilot come in to harbor
well,
you all in?
Well, he's supposed to know the destruction, you know, whatever's underneath the ocean water, you know, to keep the ship. That first plane coming around, that's it right there.
Oh,
that's
gosh.
The engine of it.
Wow.
And... That's where the engine was sticking through the bulkhead.
It's just poking out.
And this
yeah.
is just inside the wheelhouse. That's where all of them was killed. And out on each side is where those black mess attendants were. And they were just hanging in those. There was a pilot of that one ship.
The harnesses. So was he was dead in your ship? His body was in your ship?
Yeah, he was flying that plane. The one that I reported to.
Yeah. What, did you take a camera with you? Is that how you got these pictures?
No, somebody gave me those pictures.
Somebody that was on the ship
with
you? Oh,
yeah, somebody was making those pictures. There's that engine of the plane sticking through the bulkhead.
Wow.
It's the wing off the plane on the port side. That's where the side that it hit in. I got some pictures. Somewhere of that's my mama. It's me and one of the guys. But I mean, now that's kind of destruction we had. I had to come back to California and get it rebuilt.
How did you get back to California? How did the boat make it? With all
well,
that
we
damage?
Had an escort, but like I say, we had an emergency. Wheelhouse built on the back of it. All of them had that in case the wheelhouse of the ship is the first thing they hit to try to knock out. And another thing they had that might not make sense to some people, yeah, there's the haircuts.
Your cross.
Mm-hmm. There's that barrel.
Oh.
There's a royal bath. Here's the Davy Jones.
Wow.
Crossing the equator. But let's see. You guys are making the landing at Iwo Jima. There's burial at sea.
That's what was at Iwo Jima?
Yeah, this is Iwo Jima.
Well, it looks like you all were able to stop long enough to do a ceremony for that in the middle of all the battle, in the middle of the fighting. Is that true?
Well, of course, we had photographers on there that's all that they did anyway.
we carried a pretty good complement of people that operated that ship.
Yeah.
That this is the Marines that's down in the water, that's looking from the up on the ship, you know, mm-hmm. where we let the boats down, and they go down a rope ladder and get on there. Then they just rendezvous in a circle, and then when all of them got ready to go, the first wave, why, they'd go in.
Yeah. And that's Iwo Jima from the ship?
Yeah, old Suribachi.
Suribachi.
Mm-hmm. Here's a picture of me. That's where they put me off in Cavite. And I was put me on another ship to send me home.
After you all left Okinawa? Or after you left Tokyo?
Japan, yeah.
Japan, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's when I left Sandoval.
You're a tiny thing, you're right.
I guess. But these are all Saipan. These are just islands at places we stopped. Some might be some small landing or something like that.
What do you think about this, never having left Franklin County?
Well, you didn't have much time to think. You got out there. They did your thinking for you. There's some Japanese money.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's that building.
The hotel?
The one building
Yokohama.
Oh. In Yokohama. But that's the only building that was there.
That's a big one.
And the docks was back over here, and you didn't have to walk but just a little ways to.
So are these mainly Japanese people on the street, or are they
soldiers? Well, yeah,
or?
They'd be a complement of Japanese.
That is big. And this is Tokyo. This is what you were talking about, that it was just demolished. What's that building?
I don't know what that is, but and that might not even be around Yokohama.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Tokyo Bay was just a big circle, you know, and then they had cities all around Yokohama and Tokyo. But that one is a picture of part of Tokyo in the background. That's a signal gang. That's me right there.
Oh, I see. Oh, you're so young. How old were you when you joined the military?
Yeah.
How old were you?
17. I was just turning 18 when I volunteered.
Wow. Wow. So those are all the signalmen?
That's signalmen. That's how many signalmen we had on the Sandoval.
About 10 or 12.
You don't see any blacks in there?
No.
Nowhere.
You don't see any? Well, there's somebody. There's a black person there.
That must be one of the cooks.
The crew, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what he's doing in there.
Being on the ship. He was on the ship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they stayed with us. There was 26 of them. 24. They had 3 8-hour ships.
What does it mean, the Liberty Party?
Well, just when you might get off the ship and they go over and this was at Saipan, and they had what they call near beer. No alcohol in it. They said, I wouldn't drink that stuff and get drunk. They wouldn't be getting drunk. Mm-hmm. They thought they were. Some pretty good guys in there. There's old Purcelli. He's from Frankfort.
Jim Purcelli?
Mm-hmm. He's killed.
In Okinawa. Was he killed on the ship? When your ship was hit? Now, what's this one?
I don't know. This was one of those, that's old Irvin Wineman. This was one of those places in one of those islands where you go in, this place is already fixed. It's got the camera there, and you put a quarter in there, and this girl will get up there and have her picture made with you. Big deal.
Apparently. He was liking that.
These are all islands. A lot of around Cavite.
Those are
Luzon.
Wow, there's a lot of destruction.
Yeah, most of those islands are just destroyed. You know, there wasn't nothing there. Just planes would come in.
Is that something that we bombed?
Yeah.
Is that you?
I don't know. No, that's not me. That's at Cavite. Like I said, we had photographers on there that, there's a letter from Jim.
James Forrestraw. I've addressed this letter to reach you after all the formalities of your separation from active service are completed. I've done so because, without formality, but as clearly as I know how to say it, I want the Navy's pride in you, which it is my privilege to express, to reach into your civil life and to remain with you always. You've served in the greatest Navy in the world. It crushed two enemy fleets at once, receiving their surrenders only 4 months apart. It brought our land-based air power within bombing range of the enemy and set our ground armies in the beachheads of final victory. It performed the multitude of tasks necessary to support these military operations. No other Navy at any time has done so much. For your part in these achievements, you deserve to be proud as long as you live. The nation which you served at a time of crisis will remember you with gratitude. The best wishes of the Navy go with you into civilian life. Good luck. That's a very nice letter. It's from the Secretary of the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
That's very nice.
The old Purple Heart.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what this is.
Some more Japanese money.
Oh, that's it. What they made a picture of when it was here before.
Right, in the name of the President of the United States. It's for your Purple Heart Medal is awarded to the Commander Transport Squadron 13, Amphibious Forces, United States Pacific Fleet, to Luther Cart Signalman, 2nd Class, United States Naval Reserve, for wounds received in action against an enemy in the United States, May 28th, 1945. What did you all think about did you hear much communication about what was going on in the European theater? Because, I mean, they were ending their part of World War II by that point, and you all were really just...
Was what now?
Did you all hear much about what was going on in the European theater during World War II?
No, about the only thing we heard from was Tokyo Rose.
The song?
You remember Tokyo Rose?
I've heard it.
Anyhow... They convicted her. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, they did.
No, I didn't know that.
She'd say,
What did you all hear about it? I mean, what were the stories you all heard? Tell me. Tell me some.
Well, we didn't get too much outside news at all. What was happening, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, European theater, it was over before Japan was. And,
right.
And, really, I don't know. We didn't get any newspapers or anything like that. Get a letter from home, and and then you write one home. They would cut half of it out before it gets there. They'd censor it. You know, you couldn't tell them anything.
Yeah.
And,
well, I just wonder, like, since the European theater was finishing and you all were still fighting really heavily. Did you all have an idea that that was going on, that it was ending in other places of the world?
Oh, yeah, we knew that was happening, but, and remember, you know, when it was the armistice was signed in England and over there, but we kept us pretty well occupied in what we were doing. Never a dull moment, always something going on, you know. Yeah.
Did you ride home very often?
Of course, you had the weather to contend with and things like that. And
tell me about this typhoon. What was it like to be in a ship in the ocean in a typhoon?
Well, we missed part of that. We went by Okinawa when, about the time that that typhoon went through. But we lost some people in that, too, that were on the island, you know, that we had already taken the island and when the typhoon come through. But when we got hit, this thing jumped up at us again. You know, we'd already been there and secured the island. But it was a bad typhoon, and small ships were destroyed. And
what was it like for you to be on the boat? How were people reacting? Were they nervous? Were they sick?
When the boat sunk?
No, when you were in the typhoon. How did people on the ship, were they scared? Were they?
Oh, well, like I say, we were passing by Okinawa. That was when we were on our way to invade Japan.
See? Yeah.
That was just above Okinawa. I don't know. We see a few clouds and the wind and one thing and another. But that sea can get pretty rough.
Did you ever get seasick?
One time.
Really?
And that was on the old Chaumont. That was from going from Seattle to Kodiak to pick up the ship that I was on for 2 years and 2 months.
So was that your first time on a ship?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, went from Great Lakes, Illinois, right cross country, and put us on the old Chaumont. It used to be a kind of a showboat, you know, people could ride on. And
yeah.
But I don't know what they ever done with it. I don't know what they think. Oh. That's where I crossed the 180th meridian.
All right. You're Davy Jones, domain of the Golden Dragon.
Mm-hmm. Military Order of the Purple Heart. You're crossing the equator.
Aha. Uh-huh. Ancient Order of the Deep. You've been initiated into the mysteries of the deep. Mm-hmm. You definitely were initiated.
That was my ID card and got my fingerprints and all on it.
You look pretty angry in this picture. It looks like a mugshot. You look pretty angry.
Well, that's about what it is. It's a plank owner. After you board the ship so long, and this is now that's my original
veteran
card.
Yeah, your VA card.
Yeah. And I took that over to Lexington one day. Over there for something, I don't know what. Over to VA.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy in there, he said, "What is this?" I hadn't been there in.
This is from 1978. This card's from 1978.
That is?
Yeah, down here. Well, it may be older than that, but there's a date on it.
Well, that's when they gave me that, was when I got out of the Navy.
Oh, I bet that is, yeah. Well, it's old. You've taped it together about four times. You definitely carried it a long time. And then they gave you this other one?
That's just a VA. I belong to the DAV. That's the Disabled American Veterans. That's a military.
There's a Purple Heart card.
Purple Heart. Veterans of Foreign Wars.
Oh, my goodness.
But I was looking for, I thought sure I had that thing in here.
Your new VA?
But they sent me a new VA card. No, I don't know where it is now.
Did you ever send letters home to anyone when you were at sea, like your parents or somebody?
Yeah. You could write home, and you don't know whether they got them or not, because they read them before you'd... could mail them.
Yeah.
They'd censor them.
Did you ever get letters from home? Did you ever get letters from your parents or anybody? Did you have a girlfriend?
Oh, yeah. There's one that I wrote. It was to my mama and daddy.
San Francisco.
I think that gives the name of the little old ship that escorted us back to California when we got hit that time.
You want to read it?
Well, you can read it if you want to. I don't care.
See, dearest Mom and Pop. Is that what you called them? Mom and Pop?
Mom and Pop.
Just a few lines to
let
you know.
They're the greatest people in the world.
Oh, your parents. Here, why don't you read it for me? Can you read it for me?
Dearest Mom and Pop, just a few lines to let you know that I'm back in the States and I'm on my way home for good. Got in San Francisco yesterday morning around 7, and sure is good to see the place again and know that I don't have to ride any more ships. After we got off the ship, we went to Treasure Island. There's an island between Oakland and San Francisco. We checked in there and they told us to go on Liberty and be back on the 14th, and we would be all set to go to Great Lakes for our discharge. Then on home, we had a crowded trip coming across, but that's on a train now, just cattle trains, about all it was.
Ooh.
No sleeper, just you set up all day. Let's see, I had a crowded trip coming across, but it wasn't so awfully bad. I got acquainted with the signalman on the ship. They insisted that I eat with them and sleep in their compartment, which made it a lot better. Better trip for me. Said we came back on the USS SANGUS, LSVH. It was some kind of a tender for other ships, you know. But that's what they sent us home on. Said, when I got in here, we had a big reception party and we pulled in. They had a band for us and the Red Cross was there with coffee, donuts, and sandwiches. There were 2,500 of us on one ship. I sent Jeannie, that was my wife, a telegram as soon as I could. I suppose she has gotten it by now. I didn't get a chance to write and tell you. Not to write anymore as we left the Sandoval about 2 hours after we pulled into Manila from Yokohama. I mailed all my clothes home except just what I needed to do me until I got there. Said, have a Thanksgiving and a Christmas dinner ready, for I will be there to help you eat it. We'll see you in about a week. Lots of love, Luke.
Do you remember writing that?
Well, just as I took it out of here.
Yeah. When did you get married?
August the 26th, 1944. I got married when I left Alaska and before I got on the Sandoval.
Did she come out to Washington?
Yeah. She was on the ship. Let's see where that is. There's a picture of me.
Yeah, it is. Navy.
That's my mom and my daddy. Old farm people.
Yeah, and stamping ground, yeah.
Me and my lovely wife.
Oh, your sweetheart. So did she come back to Kentucky after you got married?
When the war was over.
Did she stay out on the West Coast while you were over in the...
No, I didn't stay out there. No, when the war was over, I came back to...
Did your wife come back to Kentucky after you got married?
Yeah, she lived. She lived out in Ball Nub.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty couple.
Was that a pretty good interview?
I enjoyed it. What about you? Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Well, I had, I don't know whether you call it earned them or not. There's a guy that died. He was in Okinawa. He was in Marines. A friend of mine lived here in Franklin.
Oh.
He and I were the same age. I'd send him a card on his birthday. Got a card from his parents. Said, well, your twin brother's dead. He died when he died.
Oh.
But both of us were born January 14th, 1922.
You shared a birthday.
Same birthday.
How was that? I mean, how did you all deal with things like that? I mean, you lost your friends from home that were going through the same things you were.
Oh, he hadn't been dead about 4 years, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, let's see.
Oh, I see.
No, I used to know him. He had a car lot right out here on Home Street. And
oh, so you all came back and did you, but...
But, I don't know, I might have met him out there, but I don't know. Anyhow, you know, you get talking and find out you got the same birthday and one thing and another. Kind of a bonding thing with friendship.
Absolutely.
I don't guess y'all can do anything about helping me get my medals.
Well, what are they? What do you need? Did you never get your Purple Heart, or what medals are you missing?
I've got 19 that I never did get.
Wow.
I got 4 Bronze Stars. Never did get them.
You never received them? Did you get the paperwork for them?
Oh, yeah, the Purple Heart. They would go help me out get them, and they sent my papers and everything to Veterans Administration, the hospital on Zorn Avenue in
Lexington,
Louisville.
Oh, Louisville.
Never did hear anything from them. Okay. The last thing I heard from military was you've earned your medals. Said go to any PA or any, you know, supply house, military supply house, and said you could buy them. I'm not going to buy them.
Yeah.
But those that are circled are the ones that I got.
Yeah, they should give these to you. Well, I can call the Kentucky Department of Veterans Affairs and see and have them give you a call. Sometimes it helps. I'll see if I can get someone to get a hold of you.
Well, there was a catalog came to my house, and of course they just sell stuff like that, and I tore that page out. And mm-hmm. I just circled the ones that I'm eligible for that I just didn't get.
Well, why don't you keep that, and I'll have them get a hold of you, and I'll try and get someone to call you about that, because they should do that. I'll see what I can find out.
Okay. But when they say if you can go and buy them, I don't think if you earned them that you should have to buy them.
I agree. So what'd you do for a living after the Navy?
When I got out?
Mm-hmm.
Bill May used to be a contractor mm-hmm. in Frankfurt. You ever know Bill May?
I know who Bill May is, for sure. It's hard not to when you're in Frankfurt.
But he had a little woodworking plant out at Thornhill.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when I got out of the Navy, I was married, didn't have any kids, but had a wife and need to go to work. And I went out there one day, and they put me to work as a helper in the mail room. Of course, it's sawing lumber and stuff like that. And my daddy was a carpenter and a farmer. And they put me in there as helping the mill foreman, Ralph Pulliam, mm-hmm. that had, he took care of the sawing little stuff and measuring it out, one thing and another. And I stayed right with him. I listened to what he had to say and what he'd put me doing and how he wanted it done, and I must have done all right. But Ralph had a little problem of hitting the bottle, booze. And so Mr. May came in the plant out there. Of course, those buildings are still there. The state owns them now. Those Quonset huts, right about as far as before you go up Thornhill toward Owington. Well, anyway, Mr. May came out in the plant, and Hemp was there, and he was been hitting the bottle pretty good.
Yeah.
And of course, Hemp was a fine fellow as far as I was concerned, but he did have that problem.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, Mr. May was either in a bad mood or something in it. And started talking to Hemp. He says, "Have you been drinking?" "Yes, and I took a drink a while ago." He said, "Well, I'm going to fire you." He said, "I told you, the next time I caught you drinking, you're going to be fired." "Why, you can't fire me." He said, "Who's going to do this work for you?" He said, "Luther." "Talking about me, I've been helping him, see." Mm-hmm. And well, he could do the work all right, but said, "You need me to lead out here." "No," Hemp said, "we're through with you. You're gone." Put me in there and mill for me. Went from there and started building houses. And then from there, Fred Lewis and Henry Architects, called me from Louisville. How they got my name, I don't know. might have been some support from Mr. May or somebody like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, they said they would like for me to come down there and talk with them. That's Lewis and Henry Architects. Pretty nice firm. Mm-hmm. Nice people. Both dead now. Mr. Lewis is dead, and so is Mr. Henry. Mr. Henry married Virginia Montgomery. Montgomery Shoe Factory used to be right out here. Anyhow, he met her. They got married. He's older than me. And anyhow, through the course of working for them, worked for them for 28 years.
Wow.
And retired. But he told me one day, he said, Luther said, we'll never come back to Frankfort. Virginia, she's getting pretty old, and he was too. And he said, anyway, he said, when time comes for us to move on, said, we're going to be cremated. But said, we've got two cemetery lots up here. Says, you can have them if you want them, just like that. But there are tombstones up there, got their names on them when they were born, but not when they died. Nobody ever been back, but I never did pursue it any, but
that's
anyhow, I got those two.
That's
but they're wonderful people.
Yeah.
Anyhow, they're doing the courthouse now.
Oh.
That's Lewis and Henry.
I didn't know that. That's a big thing for Frankfort.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm sure you have a million other things we could sit here and talk about, but this has been really interesting. Really interesting. So, is there anything else you want to add about this experience or anything else, or you feel like we're good?
Well, I don't know. Reckon we got it all.
I don't know if you ever get it all, but I think we got a lot.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and
stop. Oh, there's a lot of things, you know, you kind of slip your mind and you...
Well.